After 10 years at Wesleyan, John Hickenlooper found himself laid off from his first job as a geologist. So he rented a space in an empty warehouse in an empty pocket of Denver's downtown to open a brew pub. He turned out to be a natural at the job. The pub was a huge success. In 15 years, he blossomed from small business owner into millionaire at the helm of a string of pubs across the western United States. He was so influential in the community that, encouraged by many, he ran for governor of Denver, essentially as a lark, but then he won. Doubling down in politics, he then ran for governor of Colorado in 2010 and won again, tackling a host of volatile issues from prison reform to fracking, capital punishment to same-sex marriage, and legalized marijuana. Hickenlooper's administration has persuaded opposing constituencies of a true battleground state to agree and move forward on a middle path, all while dealing with tragic wildfires, floods, and the assassination of a cabinet member. The governor is here to talk about his new memoir, The Opposite of Woe, My Life in Beer and Politics, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Governor John Hickenlooper to the program this morning. Governor, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be on.
Very nice to have you on the program. You know, I met you a number of years ago at an event you were doing in Denver, and I was you were giving a talk, I believe, at the Tattered Cover, and I was very impressed by you, and I thought that you seem to be a person, and having covered many politicians over the years, I can't always say this, but you seem to be a person who genuinely loves their job.
There's no question. I've been lucky. I mean, some would say unlucky, right? I love being a geologist, but then the price of oil collapsed and the company got sold. We all got laid off. But then I fell into, I didn't fall into it. It took 2 years of, you know, trying to raise money and put it together. But we opened the Wine Coop Brewing Company, you know, a restaurant that brewed its own beer back in 1988. And it turned out I really did love that, more than I could have ever imagined loving being a geologist. And then after 15 years of that, all my customers kept saying, you know, I kept telling them, because they complained about every city council member, every congressperson, they're all bums. I said, listen, this is America. If you're not happy with our representation, well, you should run. And somehow they flipped that on me. And I did. I ran as a lark. Wouldn't do any. Never did a negative ad. It was the first time I ran for anything in my whole life. And we won with 65% of the vote. It was this strange, and Denver's a strong mayor form of government. The mayor has a great deal of power. But I love that. I mean, that turned out to be even more suited for my temperament and my disposition than running a big restaurant or a string of restaurants. So I have been very, very fortunate to continue to have these let's call them career changes, where I end up in a job that I love even more than the one I had before.
One of the things, and do you think I'm this is too much of a stretch, but it seems to me that people who are in the craft beer movement and who are moving into towns and are finding out that this is the centerpiece of a community, that the reason that people look to you is because that place suddenly becomes the center of the community. I mean, isn't that essentially what I got that sense in the book, that essentially this place, this what some would call a bar, you're brewing beer, and it becomes the centerpiece of the community.
Well, in a funny way, it does become a meeting place. We were, you know, the recession was so bad in the mid-80s in Colorado that our rent, when we signed the lease in 1987, our rent was $1 per square foot per year. I mean, it was just a landscape of abandoned warehouses. And so we went out of our way to try and, you know, I'd serve on nonprofit boards. We'd have a meeting at the restaurant. We'd do everything we could to make it kind of a hub for the activity downtown. And we worked with other restaurants, and there weren't that many of them, to, you know, do group advertising. So come to Lower Downtown Denver, come to Lodo, and you can go to any of these five restaurants. That kind of collaborative approach, and it worked very well. Lodo became, you know, more of a magnet. They ended up in 1995 opening Coors Field in Lodo, so we went from being very successful to being very, very, very successful. That collaborative approach that works so well in Lodo really is what we've used as mayor and then more recently as governor to try and bring together opposing sides, create a sense of community and collaboration, and figure out solutions to the problems we have.
For the problems that you have in your state, do they mirror the problems that we see in the rest of the country? And I guess I'm curious as to the problems that you see that are unique to Colorado.
Yeah, I think, well, we have both. And many of the problems we have here, you see all over the country. So issues between, you know, with horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, that's become a very big issue for a lot of people. And, you know, we tried to bring the oil and gas industry into the same room with the environmental community, right? The Environmental Defense Fund, some of the big national environmental defenders, and to say, all right, if there's oil and gas in a community, how do we make sure there are no spills? How do we make sure there's no contamination of either surface water or especially groundwater? How do we make sure that there's not, you know, leakage of methane into the atmosphere and causing air pollution? And I think that's the super challenge here is you've got an industrial process that in many cases ends up, you know, getting too close to housing. So we push back the length of, in other words, you have to be further away from homes. We went to great lengths to make sure that there would not be groundwater pollution. And I think that's what people have a right to expect, that we keep their communities safe.
You ultimately support fracking in your state.
I think it's an industrial process, and I think in the right place it can be done safely. But there's, I think it needs to be very, very tightly regulated. It is one of the more difficult issues we face because it's so polarizing. There are a lot of people that hate fracking in any sense, no matter what. But at the same time, we're all driving automobiles. We all are using electricity. And fracking allows us to harvest natural gas at a low enough cost so that we are rapidly converting coal plants all over the country into natural gas, which is dramatically cleaner. I think that's especially when it starts happening in China and India, at that point, we really do begin to clean up the entire, you know, the air pollution all around the globe and begin to make a serious dent into fighting climate change.
You say that you, I believe you told the Senate committee that you actually drank a glass of fracking fluid produced by an oil field. that's true,
yeah,
right?
Well, here's the situation. We're sitting in my office with a guy who is the CEO of Halliburton, one of the big service companies. They're the ones who actually do the fracking, and
yeah,
they have the frack fluid. And at that time, they weren't willing to share, you know, the secret ingredients of their frack fluid because they thought it would give their competitors an advantage. And so the rumor mill, you know, the conspiracy theorists were saying that, well, there's something in there that's really evil. And they had created a prototype of frack fluid that was too expensive to use at that point, but they were continually lowering the price. But this prototype was called, I think it was called Clean Stim, but it was made with all food ingredients. In other words, everything had been approved for use in foods by the Food and Drug Administration. And basically, I wanted to get this guy to trust me so I could convince him that just like Coca-Cola lists the ingredients of the secret formula of what makes Coca-Cola so delicious, they still put the ingredients on the bottle. They just don't give you the formula. So after, you know, some discussion, I could tell that Mr. Lazar still didn't really trust me, and he had this jar of Clean Stim, and he had taken a drink of it publicly. So I volunteered. I took a sip of it, just to build that trust, so that we could eventually get him to agree to reveal the components of what was in frack fluid, and he did that.
Then Senator Franken said that he thought it perhaps was some part of some bizarre occult practice.
Yeah, well, it certainly got reported out of context a number of times. And what I was trying to do is, you know, what the approach we use generally in Colorado when we have conflict is to try and get both sides in the room and and I try to just listen harder, right? If you're trying to persuade someone to look at an issue in a fresh way, to go ahead and tell them what you think and tell them what you think they should think, generally you don't get so far. But if you really listen to people and continue asking questions about where they're coming from and what their perspective is, it's funny. People are more open then to look at a broader range of solutions, maybe a broader self-interest for their own outcome. And that's when you get to compromises, and that's how we get to progress.
Do you believe so? This all started off, and I don't want to dominate this conversation about fracking, but I am curious about. Do you believe? Because we started off by talking about if this was an issue that was specifically about Colorado. Do you think your position would change if you were in Pennsylvania or if you were in New York as governor?
Well, certainly it depends on how deep the wells are drilled and what, you know, where groundwater is. You know, where are you getting your where are your water wells getting their water from? And I think each case is different. And I, you know, what works in Colorado is not necessarily going to work in New York. I do think that about the greenest state, I think we were the first state where the voters set a renewable energy standard, and that we would get to 30% by 2024, and we have, or actually it's later than that, but anyway, the we have some of the fastest growing wind energy farms, some major solar electrical generation facilities in place. You know, ultimately, we realize we've got to get to a green future where we have absolutely clean energy that hopefully will be as inexpensive and as reliable as the energy system we have now. But I still think that natural gas has got to be part of that transition to get us to wean us off coal as we continue to try and lower the cost of wind and solar, both of which are intermittent, right? We've got to make sure we have energy for those cloudy days where the wind doesn't blow.
When it comes to this presidential election, as a Democrat who is often finds himself on a short list of vice presidential candidates, what do you make of this particular race? The continuation of the Bernie Sanders campaign and where we are right now.
Well, you've got to admit, it's the craziest primary season that anyone's seen, I think. Certainly in my lifetime, the Donald Trump, you know, someone who is, in my opinion, I think really a bully and kind of a blowhard, that so many people would want him to be the model. You know, the president of the United States is the person that the children model their behavior on, right? And we want our children to grow up being like that, you know, self-centered and egotistical and really kind of a bully. And then on the other side, you have Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders in this battle that I think most people didn't think it would be this intense and go on this long. But Senator Sanders, you know, he's really a visionary. He's laid out a lot of issues. He's crystallized a lot of issues. And I think in many ways he's made Secretary Clinton a stronger candidate just by she's gone through this campaign and she's grown. Just look at how much she's grown over the past, I think, 9 months, the past 12 months. And I think the fact that the campaign has gone on so long, I mean, I think I'm pretty clear. I am very confident that Secretary Clinton will be the candidate, but I think Senator Sanders has earned that right to, you know, run as long as he wants. Now, I have full trust that in the end, assuming that Secretary Clinton does win, and I think she will, I think that Senator Sanders will support her strongly and make sure that we unite as a party at the convention in Philadelphia, and we come out united and run a great campaign right through till November.
When I was telling people that I was going to interview you, and I didn't even really think of this, but everybody had the same response, and that was about the legalization of marijuana. Do you get that around the country?
Oh yeah, it's that. The one good thing about Trump, you know, making such an impact is that now marijuana isn't the first thing that I always get asked. But it is. I mean, we legalized marijuana a little over 3 years ago, and you know, largely it's because Colorado has been such a destination over the last 10 or 15 years for young people. I mean, we've been either first or second for the last 8 years as a destination for millennials. And what that means is we have all these young people here, and so many of them don't see a big difference between marijuana and whiskey or beer. And so they're the ones who put it on the ballot, and they're the ones, I mean, I oppose it. Almost every elected official opposed it just because, I mean, you don't want to be in conflict with federal law. It's not an easy situation. And to create a regulatory framework from scratch, that's a steep hill to climb. But I think, you know, over these last 3 years, I think we've done a pretty good job. You know, if after the election, if I'd had a magic wand and I could have reversed the vote so that it failed, I probably would have done that. Now, if I had a magic wand, I'd probably wait a year or probably wait 2 years and see if this incredible social experiment that we're doing, if it actually works. Because there is some indications we're beginning to get anecdotal reports of a lot fewer drug dealers. And drug dealers don't care who they sell pot to, right? They'll sell the kids, whoever. We were very concerned that legalizing it would give a big spike in the use of marijuana by teenagers. We haven't seen that yet. Really almost a very, very modest increase, but very modest and certainly nothing like a spike.
And you're the guinea pig. I mean, all the other states are looking at you and Washington and the others to see how it's going.
Yeah, I get a couple calls a week from other governors asking, you know, my opinion and what would I suggest to them. And I'm pretty consistent in just saying I'd wait a couple years because we don't know if there are going to be unintended consequences that so far we haven't seen. And I think prudence in a situation like this is probably the right way to go. Let's make sure that this thing really works before we start, you know, legalizing it all over the country.
Well, the name of the book is The Opposite of Woe, My Life in Beer and Politics. Governor John Hickenlooper, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
No, it was a real treat. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. Again, Governor John Hickenlooper is the governor of the state of Colorado. He joins us this morning. The name of the book, The Opposite of Woe, My Life in Beer and Politics. It's published by Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.